Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, some critics say a program in the Pima County Jail that's supposed to help people with mental illness is actually keeping them locked up.
And we'll help you out if you're looking for the perfect book to give this holiday season.
But first, there are more than 10,000 kids in Arizona on a wait list for assistance to pay for childcare. That represents nearly 6,000 families. The numbers come from the State Department of Economic Security and are as of the end of November. Arizona reinstated its waitlist last summer after federal pandemic money ran out. The state has put money into childcare subsidies as costs continue to rise, but it's also lost an additional $24 million federal dollars. I spoke about this earlier with Rebecca Gao, executive director of Stand for Children Arizona. She says the waitlist being where it is has implications both for the state and for families.
For families, it means that they're often making the choices between having, you know, two working parents and the double income that is quite necessary sometimes or often with the rising prices today. So it means that they're having to make a decision for one of those earners to not work. Childcare costs can take up to 17%. Of a family's budget or income. And that's a lot. And then we're seeing for younger people that they're simply choosing not to start their family or not to grow their family because they're seeing the cost of actually raising kids is, you know, higher than they can bear. So there's that level, which is certainly, you know, very concerning. In terms of the state level, that also translates into lower revenues. If you don't have folks earning an income and you don't have folks spending as much money, it reduces the amount of money coming to the state in taxes. It reduces the impact to the economy in general. And some folks estimate that's about a $5 billion hit to the economy. And then there are also estimates coming out of the Center for Future of Arizona that there could be a $12 billion impact to the economy. So we're not just talking about the very real and very important impact on families and Arizonans. We're also talking about our impact overall to meet our budgetary obligations.
Well, so the legislature and governor this year put a not insignificant amount of money into childcare, and yet the list is where it is. So why is that?
Federal cuts. It's short and simple. Originally, those of us who were working on this issue estimated that the state investment of $45 million on top of the federal investment would cut that wait list in half to what it was at the time, which was actually lower than this. And then all those federal cuts started happening, and that completely wiped out the benefit. It was fortunate we got the state money in ahead of time to supplement what the federal cuts were going to be. So the money that wasn't invested this summer, that was a combination of federal and state, then got slashed in the fall because of the federal changes.
Is there a sense of how much money the state would need to put into this program to overcome the federal cuts or to significantly bring the waitlist down?
Yes, it would cost about $165 million a year to eliminate the waitlist. So we're talking about a not insignificant amount, but also much less than some other programs are costing the state. And also, we recently conducted a survey of Arizonans who agree, like we gave them options, what you would prefer, like current level, enough to cut the wait list in half and enough to eliminate the wait list entirely. And we gave them the amounts, and the majority of Arizonans are for either increasing or completely reducing, and over 35%. And it was a plurality, right? So the most respondents said, let's eliminate it completely.
Well, so as you say, you know, $165 million, you know, in real money is an awful lot of money. But, you know, when you look at it in the context of a many, many, many billion dollar state budget, you know, it's not a huge component of it. At the same time, though, the governor has said that the state is not really in a position to make up for federal cuts in areas like SNAP and food benefits, things like that. Do you have any measure of optimism that the legislature and governor will have that money, especially given, as you referenced earlier, where we are in terms of state finances?
Yeah. I mean, you never know.
Okay.
I've been doing this long enough to know that where there's a will, there can be a way. The real trick here is where the revenue is going to come from. So there's some slight small indications that we might be in a situation where there's slightly more money for 1 year than was anticipated. And I doubt it's going to be, you know, enough to cover the childcare wait list. So then you come into, okay, what are some other options? Well, raising revenue. That's a very, very difficult thing with this legislature. The fact is that we are in a budget deficit, and the easiest way out of that is to ease off of the really significant tax cuts that were enacted a few years ago. That is a very, very high lift that this legislature is very, very, very unlikely to do, but I think it has to be a real solution that people are aware of could be done, and the legislature is choosing not to do it. There are other ways to think about it. The governor had proposed in her last budget a public-private partnership between businesses and the state and parents. And this has been tried in a few other states with interesting results, not quite, I think, what folks had hoped, but promising. And the idea is that an employer would cover a third of the childcare costs, the state would cover a third, and then the parents would cover a third. I think it's definitely worth digging into how we could make it work in Arizona. I do want to mention another potential solution that the state of New Mexico implemented recently. And that is their state land trust, using their state trust land to fund childhood for everybody, regardless of their income. So that could be done as well.
I'm wondering where you think the number of families on the wait list goes from here. Like, do you think it will continue to go up? Do you think at some point it will go down? Like, what do you think?
It's definitely going to go up for a while. I mean, we've been watching it over the last few months. About 150 additional families a week have been being added to the wait list as we've been watching this fall. So until something changes with inflation or, you know, state budget pressures or federal budget pressures, until any of those things change, it's going to continue to go up about 150 families a week.
How does that increase compare to what we have seen in the past? Like, have you seen other times when 150 families join the wait list in a given week, like consistently?
No. I mean, this seems to be happening rather quickly. What we prefer to see is those numbers go down. And there was a time in which they were at least flat or going down. But that hasn't been happening for the last 6 months, at least.
All right. That is Rebecca Gao, Executive Director of Stand for Children Arizona. Rebecca, always nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. My pleasure.
Lots of people in the mental health world will tell you that in this country, jail is the default psychiatric ward. Pima County's Restoration to Competency program was meant to help to prepare people with mental illness to face trial. But our next guest this morning reports criminal justice and healthcare experts are sounding the alarm about the program, arguing it's keeping people with mental illness in jail and not in treatment, and it's putting overwhelmed jail staff and inmates in a dangerous position. John Washington is reporter for Arizona Luminaria in Tucson, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Thanks for coming back on the show, John.
Yeah, great to be here.
Okay, so I want to start with this Restoration to Competency program and how it's supposed to work. Tell us that.
Yeah, so The situation is very complicated, but basically, anyone who is facing criminal prosecution needs to be able to understand the court proceedings and even assist in their own defense for a trial to proceed. And if there's a question whether they are competent enough to do that, they can be entered into these programs. Many other localities throughout the country have set up a restoration to competency program, which assesses whether or not they have achieved a basic level of competency to proceed. Meanwhile, they receive some education, and in the jail, because there is some mental health treatment available, very basic, they're also receiving that. So a lot of people say, well, it kind of seems like they're basically in a mental hospital, and yet they're very much not. They're in a carceral setting, and most of the people who they actually have engagement with are not trained to deal with mental health issues or not trained to do any sort of evaluation. And that sort of disconnect puts people in many cases in harm's way or eventually keeps them in jail for longer, actually.
Okay, so let's talk about a case that you highlight in the story, the case of Stacy Brooks. First of all, just tell us about him, how he ended up in this program.
Well, Stacy had been in and out of jail a couple times. They were for relatively minor offenses. He was accused in this last case of assaulting an officer with a metal water bottle. And he went started going through the system. His attorney thought that he was maybe not competent enough to stand trial, and so he was entered into this program. He was also on court-ordered medication, in which the court makes people actually give him basic medication that he needs, hopefully to improve his situation. And he was refusing those meds. And that is not an uncommon scenario. And yet, the people who were administering those meds or helping to administer those meds, again, weren't really trained to do so. They were trained to respond to crisis or keep people locked up. And so what we saw was when he refused, they came in and they tased him multiple times. They beat the hell out of him, and then they pinned him down and let a nurse come in and give him an injection.
Yeah, you obtained body cam footage of that incident, and we're going to listen to a little bit of audio from that body camera footage. A warning: this audio may not be appropriate for all audiences.
You need a taser? After the taser, go ahead. Go lie behind.
How far are you gonna get taste? Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind.
You're breaking my fingers. Stop.
Stop resisting that.
I'm not resisting anymore. All right, big boy.
Ready for the shots?
I'm not moving.
John, tell us, what does this example and that footage reveal to you about how this program is functioning for folks?
Yeah, it's a really gruesome video. And I've actually obtained another video of Stacy getting beat up in an earlier instance as well. The correctional officers and the sheriff's department say, well, look, he was being combative and resistant. That is clearly true. I mean, that you can see that on the video. And yet, there are ways, experts that I talked to explain that there are clearly ways to de-escalate, to take time, and to engage with him to try to convince him to take the medication, which wasn't really done. There was a 30-second video of somebody trying in very basic and sort of meager fashion to get him to take the medication, and it didn't happen. What people say is like this is basically follows the hammer nail dynamic, is when you have these all of these tools and these people who are trained to clamp down, to resist violently, and when someone has some other sort of need, they don't have the training to provide anything else but that sort of really intense crackdown that we see in this video.
Right. And the sheriff in Pima County has talked about this as well and talked about the impact this program has on his staff. What's he said?
Right. Oh, I mean, this presents enormous challenges, unwanted challenges for the sheriff's department. The sheriff has been very clear that he thinks a lot of the people who are in this program and in other situations where they have mental health crises shouldn't be in jail. And yet, there just isn't capacity. Arizona, along with many other states, is at crisis levels of lack of mental health hospital beds. There just aren't really systems to treat these people. And so we're relying on the system that has continued to be flush with money, and that is the jail and the criminal justice system.
What does the county have to say about this program and how it's working? Are they defending it?
Well, That's a little bit complicated. There are many parts. This is one of the things I learned is how really complex the system is. And a lot of the information and a lot of the expertise is rather siloed. So some people have a small window in parts of the program, but don't really understand the whole thing. And that was a real challenge to report. Some people say their piece of the system is working well. One official told me that it's working perfectly. Mm-hmm. And yet we have cases like this where I think anyone would say that it was a huge stretch to call this system perfect right here. But they also don't have the money to put in to really try to address this in a more systemic fashion, which is what people who really study this say needs to happen.
Yeah. So last 30 seconds there, John, give us a sense of what experts say would be better.
Well, it's a slow turnaround of this ship that has been sailing in a certain direction for a long time. You really need to address these underlying crises. There's mental health, there's opioid addiction, there's homelessness. These are all converging and pushing people into the system. Turning it around is hard, but starting to refund and put more money into objectives that can actually treat these people up front, who can stave this, keep them away from falling down off of these sort of critical cliffs in the first place, is the only true fix, is what people tell me.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. John Washington with Arizona Luminaria joining us from Tucson. John, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a holiday gift guide for the book lovers in your life.
But first, let's head to southern Arizona, to the small town of Benson, where four of the six members of their city council are now facing recall elections. A group of residents called Committee for a Better Benson gathered enough signatures to force the recall vote last week. It all goes back to 2024, when the Benson Planning and Zoning Commission issued a variance to a company that wants to build an aluminum recycling facility in the area. Proponents said the big project could bring jobs to the region, but when residents in the area caught on to what had been approved, many were outraged. They raised concerns about environmental hazards, health impacts, and more. And they said the city hadn't informed them that the facility was coming. But council members say they followed all the proper procedures to greenlight the project, and there's nothing they can do to change it. Well, residents aren't taking that lying down, and they started gathering signatures for a recall. Terry Jo Neff is a local reporter with Herald Review Media who's been covering the controversy and filled me in on the latest.
Folks just decided, Lauren, that, you know, if the council is not going to be receptive to our concerns, maybe it's time to get some of those council members out of there a few years early. And they initiated the recall process.
Okay, so this is an indirect response to this proposed aluminum plant that's coming to Benson that we've had you on the show to talk about before, which has been very controversial. Why go after the city council? Like, is this kind of the only thing that residents can do?
Well, it is at this point. They can perhaps try to challenge Arizona Department of Environmental Quality if and when the necessary permit is issued. But as far as getting local officials to pay attention, you know, part of the problem that we have here, Lauren, is from the city's perspective, and they've had a lot of lawyers review this, mm-hmm. they don't see that anything was done wrong in the process of getting the variance, the special use permit, and all of that done. And, you know, all of the checklist was followed, so to speak. But the majority of the community that could be impacted if there is a health public safety issue at the facility knew nothing about it. There's already a lawsuit against the planning and zoning process that's going to be heard in court early 2026. So the recall, I think, was part frustration and also just part hoping that if they could get the mayor and enough of the six city council people, you know, out of office, maybe they could get some folks in there who would be a little bit more responsive to some of the concerns.
So let me ask you, just to paint a picture for us, like, if and when this plant is built, what will this look like due to this very small community in Benson?
So it's a 200-acre property, the building sites themselves are less than 10 acres. The problem, though, is lying to the east is the San Pedro River.
Mm-hmm.
To the immediate west of the property, like literally a hop, skip, and a jump across a highway, you have a nursing home. You have a lot of low-income housing that's there. And so even though it's not right in the heart of downtown Benson, it's a big facility. It's one, just the one of the buildings is 88 feet tall. It's then going to have a couple of 100 foot tall cooling stacks. The building itself is not going to be that much different in, you know, in structure. We have a lot of industrial buildings, but it is big. It's going to bring in semi-truck traffic. Then again, a lot of businesses cause semi-truck traffic. And it's going to be very interesting to see who chooses to run against these four council members.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody has to run against each person. And you don't know. We may end up with the same four council members in the end. They could end up with four brand new council members who would take office right in June.
Hmm. Okay, so have we heard any response from these four city council members who are now going to either have to choose whether to run or just resign?
We haven't yet. There's a lot of moving parts to this story. And it's, again, it's going to be interesting to see who happens to step up and say, all right, I'm willing to put my name in the hat and I want to get on the council.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. So, I mean, this issue over this aluminum plant has really, it sounds like, divided this community in Benson. You live there in Benson and have been covering mm-hmm. this all along. What's this done to the town, to the community, to this, you know, to the people?
You know, it is caused friction within families. It has caused friction within churches. Longtime friends, you know, in some cases are on opposite ends here. Very interesting that ranchers, farmers who are typically not eager to embrace kind of the radical environmentalists are all coming together on this issue. Unfortunately, as with a lot of things like this, a lot of controversies, you do have folks that are on really the extremes who sometimes get a lot of the attention. Just last week, one of the very vocal opponents was like, hey, we need to get rid of the developmental plan so that we have the community votes on who gets to build any business in town. You know, which just totally had the other side throwing up their hands. The other part, too, as I mentioned, there's the lawsuit. There is still the chance, slim as it is, that a court would say, hey, Benson, you really did things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if that judge happens to say, yeah, Benson did everything right? They followed the law. And then what are those, let's say four new council members are on there.
Right.
What are they going to do? They're going to have to abide by the judge's order. So it is, there's so many different parts to this. We're probably looking at another 2 months before we really have a clearer idea.
Okay. Lots to watch for down in Benson, Arizona. That is Terry Jo Neff, reporter for Herald Review Media in Cochise County. Terry Jo, thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
The Nobel Peace Prize will be handed out this week to an opposition political leader from Venezuela. She was announced the winner earlier this year. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, can you please tell us more about this?
Yeah, she is a remarkable woman. Her name is Maria Corina Machado Parisca, and she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for this year back in October. She was, in other words, it was announced that she would get it. So this is not news. But this week, she is supposed to be going to Oslo, the Norwegian capital, to actually pick this thing up, to be awarded it in person. However, There is a backstory to this, which is that she is a very prominent opposition figure in Venezuela, her home country, and has been for many, many years. And she's very against the government, the current government of Nicolas Maduro. In fact, she entered the elections last year at which Mr. Maduro won a third term in office, 6-year term in office. And those elections were regarded as rigged, as illegitimate. And she has been in hiding for much of the time since. And the government, she's definitely regarded as, if you like, in inverted commas, an enemy of the state. To the point where Venezuela says, well, if she does go to Oslo to pick up this award this week, she will be classified as a fugitive in Venezuela. So this gives you some idea of the sort of background to what's going on here. So we're going to see that award ceremony in Oslo. But the big question is, will she actually be able to get there? Will she actually be able to be there in person to pick it up? And of course, this is all comes against the big background of the U.S. putting pressure, the White House putting pressure on Venezuela with those naval ships in the Caribbean and attacks also in the East Pacific, which so far have killed something like 87 people in boats that the White House says are running drugs, essentially, to the United States. And this is a very big deal, of course, globally, but certainly in Latin America. So these two things are kind of happening in tandem. But the one thing you can say is that Nicolas Maduro, the current leader in Venezuela, is under immense pressure from all sides. And once again, this week, we're going to see quite a lot on Venezuela because of this ceremony later in the week.
Sure. So, Rob, speaking of awards, this week, Time magazine will be naming its Person of the Year. It's always been regarded as a pretty significant accolade. So do we have a sense of who is in the running and maybe if there have been surprises in recent times over who gets this award?
Yes, we don't really know because they keep it pretty close to their chest, much like the Nobel Prizes. But we do know they tend to have a short list of about 10. We know that Donald Trump got it last year and Taylor Swift got it the year before. But if you go back, I mean, it's nearly 100 years old, this award. And it first came out in 1927 and, interestingly, was called the Man of the Year Award at the time, which gives you some idea of the times that they were living through. And of course, names from history pop out in terms of people who have been named Time's Person of the Year over the years. Adolf Hitler, for example, Joseph Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, all sorts of people all the way through the ages, historical figures. And that gives you an idea about this, which is not just that these people are good in any way, it's that they are influential. And that is the criteria that Time uses. So you can be good or bad. That's it, sort of immaterial, really. The big question is, are you influential? And that they'll be making this year's choice based on that same criteria as well. So maybe, I mean, conjecture here, but maybe we'll see somebody from the AI industry or something like that who's considered to have kind of extraordinary influence across the world. But that will be really interesting to see, who do they select this year? Will it be a tech person? Will it be someone else? And we should know by Thursday.
All right, that'll be interesting to see. So, Rob, finally, over the past week or so, we've seen an uptick in hostile rhetoric between China and Japan, and we're expecting this story to develop further over this coming week. Can you tell us what's going on with this?
Yeah, actually, it's developing pretty quickly. So on Saturday, just a couple of days ago, the new prime minister in Japan, she said that Chinese fighter jets twice aimed their radars at Japanese military aircraft on Saturday. She called that a dangerous act, and she demanded measures be enforced to prevent a recurrence. And that is just really the latest spat between China and Japan, which has been escalating in recent weeks and months, and especially since comments were made by the new Japanese prime minister. She was answering a parliamentary question in parliament in Japan, and she said that if China were to invade the island of Taiwan, which China regards as its own province, its own territory, and has not ruled out military action to retake Taiwan, she said if they do invade Taiwan, then Japan could get militarily involved. And that really upset China, those comments. And we've seen a lot coming off the back of that. And it comes at a tricky time because China is commemorating the 80th anniversary of World War II, which, of course, the Chinese see quite differently from, you know, the way we see that that conflict through Western eyes. And also this coming week, we're going to see, you know, commemorations of, for example, the Nanjing Massacre, which was carried out by Japanese occupying troops in China, you know, way back when. So there is a there are all these kind of historical moments that they're looking back to in China. We've also got, you know, Japanese cultural events in China now being cancelled. So Japanese bands, for example, touring China, their tours are being cancelled. This is the level of rhetoric and distrust and kind of anger between these two countries just at the moment. So we'll be watching out for that for certain this coming week.
All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now let's turn to a student journalist with a story to tell. Leo Divin Legay is a senior at Northern Arizona University and the editor-in-chief of The Lumberjack, the student newspaper there. Normally, he writes about environmental issues or things that are happening in Flagstaff. But recently, after the assassination of Charlie Kirk and the conversation that followed about his killer's motivation and transgender partner, Legay felt the need to write something much more personal. It's a letter from the editor titled A Byline Change, and it's essentially his coming out as transgender in a professional way. In it, he writes about his frustration with the coverage of trans people in much of the media, but also about his uncertainty about talking about his own transgender identity as a journalist. My impending gender transition and my journalism aspirations appeared at odds, he wrote. See, as journalists, we're supposed to stay unbiased, outside observers on the events we report on. But could he be seen as unbiased as a trans person, an identity that has become something stigmatized and politicized by forces outside his control? Legay thought so, and I spoke with him more about why.
I've always known that there was something about me. I've always known that I was not a woman, and I never truly processed that, or at least I was procrastinating processing that. I figured I would get my life together first, and then I would figure out all of the gender identity issues. And then it was really when I got to college, when I made trans friends, when I reflected more inwardly that I realized that I couldn't keep procrastinating this very real part of my life.
So you, it sounds like, recently began sort of taking medication to kind of formally transition. And you weren't at first going to talk about this publicly. You were going to kind of finish college and just sort of keep this to yourself for a while?
Yes, because it always felt very personal and internal. And it still does, frankly. I didn't intend for this piece that I wrote to be a big coming out piece. It was really venting about things that I saw around me and experiences I was having as a trans person and somebody who was aspiring to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to express that and also express solidarity with the trans people around me who I work with.
Yeah. So, yeah, tell us about what it is that led to you wanting to write this, where you felt like you, it almost sounds like from the piece, you felt like you needed to speak out.
A lot of it came from the aftermath of the Charlie Kirk assassination, because a lot of the news coverage that was coming out around that time was talking about trans people. A lot of it was not actually relevant, though, and watching that unfold made me feel very angry about the state of journalism and how trans people were being spoken about. And then I was seeing how it was affecting my newsroom, because a lot of staff on the Lumberjack are trans, and they wanted to discuss these events and go down to Phoenix for the memorial and go to vigils that we're having on campus. But they were worried about how being trans would affect their ability to cover these events. And that really upset me, and I wanted to speak about that.
Right. Okay. So you made this decision. You wrote this piece. It's called A Byline Change, right? Which makes sense in terms of changing your own name. But I mean, you write this line, right? You say, you say that your impending gender transition and your journalism aspirations seem to be at odds. You write, how can I be perceived as an unbiased source when my existence as a transgender person is inherently stigmatized and politicized? Tell us what you meant by that.
Yeah. Being trans is treated as inherently political. And that's hard for somebody who wants to go into a field as somebody that's unbiased. I think that I am capable and willing to put news out there without any sort of political angle, but I fear that because I'm trans, I'm perceived as having that implicit bias, and that feels unfair to me.
So when you talk about your colleagues being concerned about even being able to cover events, whether or not it's, you know, the perception of how they might cover them, what are the concerns there? This has to do with, you know, logistical things often, like ID, like, you know, just being safe.
Yeah. I remember very specifically one of our staff, one of our photographers, I believe, wanted to go to an event, the memorial. And they were worried because the name on their press pass is not the same name that they have on their ID. And I've heard different concerns about that from my staff. And that's just a barrier to entry with journalism that I think people who aren't trans don't even consider.
Hmm. So, I mean, obviously you talked about some of the stories and the media coverage spurring you to want to do this, right? To speak out. Do you think that there is an important perspective that you might be able to bring to journalism as somebody who's trans?
A lot of this coverage that I do see that I don't think has been done very well about trans people just doesn't treat trans people as human beings. Mm. And I think, you know, that's a problem. That's, you see that with any form of representation, where I think that having someone in the newsroom to call out how certain identities are being covered is important. In general, I just think that having trans people in the newsroom is necessary for that representation, because I think it's a lot harder to treat trans people as topics, as things to scapegoat, because that's hot in the media right now. It's a lot harder to think of trans people that way when you have trans people that you work with and you know and that you understand their perspectives because they're human beings.
Mm. There is a conversation. There's been a conversation in journalism and in newsrooms, I think, where, you know, we talk about not being biased, right? Like this idea of being unbiased, which I think the new generation of journalism students like yourself might question and sort of say, like, we're all biased about something and we need to be transparent, not unbiased. I wonder what you make of that in light of this argument you're making. Like, you know, it used to be you might say to somebody who's involved in an issue, well, you can't cover that issue because you're too invested. What do you think of that?
I think it's difficult. When I was writing this, I felt very emotional, and that was odd to me because this was the first thing that I've ever written that wasn't a news or feature piece. Mm. I never feature my own voice. And that felt very odd and wrong to me.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, I don't write about trans people very much. I mostly write about like environmental topics or local Flagstaff news. So that is a question. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the people covering news about trans people right now are biased in the sense that they are ignorant to a lot of these issues that are happening.
Mm.
It goes both ways. And I think that I would much rather rely on somebody who's in the community, and maybe they do have some personal ties and emotions, but any good journalist would be able to get past that if they know what they're talking about. I would much prefer that than to read something by somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about and is ignorant. Hmm. Because then they can't put out the truth, which is at the end of the day, the journalist's job.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. And in the end, what you're doing here, you say, is a thank you, like saying thank you for telling these stories, these people like me who might be worried about doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think what has inspired me to come out specifically in a professional journalistic setting and write things under my chosen name is that I want to be like the trans people I see around me in journalism. And so it was a thank you for almost being braver than I was before. And a thank you for inspiring me.
Well, that is Leo Divin Legay joining us, senior at NAU and editor-in-chief of The Lumberjack up there. Leo, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you talking about this.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. As you make your way into the thick of the holiday shopping season, chances are you've had the experience of walking into a bookstore and freezing up. With so many choices lining the shelves, how on earth are you supposed to narrow down your options? Thankfully, Valley-based writer and critic Mark Athatakis has some recommendations for the various categories of book lover you may have in your life. He spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman, and they started with Mark's ideal choice for the aspiring fiction writer.
The book I wanted to point to is called A Long Game, Notes on Writing Fiction by Elizabeth McCracken. And I think anybody who goes to a bookstore will see a host of ways to sell your first novel, write your first novel, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll have all sorts of guidance about you need to write every day, you need to do this, you need to do that or the other. And I think one thing that's special about this book by Elizabeth McCracken, who has been nominated multiple times for a National Book Award, she teaches in an MFA program, she knows whereof she speaks, is that the main thing that she gives is a lot of permission. She is not an enthusiast of the idea, oh, you must write every day or you must do everything. She does have some specific recommendations that are very helpful, but it's more often drawing from her own failures. So, you know, she is a very successful writer, but she is also very candid about the experiences that she has had writing for years on a particular book that just did not get over and why it didn't. So one thing that any writer has to get used to is the feeling of failure.
This sounds like such a perfect choice for somebody who is maybe in that headspace where they're telling themselves like, I'm not cut out for this. Real writers have a process. I don't have a process. I'm going to not be able to attribute this, but I saw a really great tweet once from a fiction writer who it was during a period where there was a lot of conversation about Medicaid benefits in Congress, and the phrase waste, fraud, and abuse was being thrown around. And this writer was saying, like, those three words should actually be applied to writers, because those are actually the cornerstones of a writing process. You're going to waste your time writing in directions that you don't end up going. You're going to feel like a fraud, and you're going to abuse yourself emotionally.
Yes, exactly. And I think one nice thing about this book in particular is that I think every writer's guide has a little bit of a tone to it, an attitude that it is presenting. I think often of Annie Dillard, who says that if you're going to be a writer, it is like a blind inchworm struggling to find purchase on the stem of a flower, which is not encouraging, as lovely as Annie Dillard is. So there's none of that scolding tone in this particular book.
So let's move on now, staying in the arts, to the ideal selection for the music geek.
Yes. So I think many people would be familiar with the name John Darnielle, who is really the sole person of the indie folk group The Mountain Goats, which is a very literate, very thoughtful, intellectual, but humorous and fun and smart oeuvre that he's been working on for years. He started out just making little lo-fi four-track tapes and now is a much more sophisticated musician. But he has a real knack for drawing on his life experiences into song, and he has put together a book called This Year, which is a compendium of 365 of his song lyrics along with personal stories, sometimes about how this particular song came to be, sometimes just about a personal experience and why this song just sort of fits with it.
And am I right that this is – the title of this book is an allusion to his song where the chorus is, I am going to make it through this year?
If it kills me.
I'm not like a huge mountain goats fan or anything, but I have always been fascinated by the degree to which John seems to be able to evoke such a wide range of emotional responses in people, in spite of the fact that his lyrics are so specific to his life. He has a song called The Best Ever Death Metal Band Out of
East Texas.
Texas. Yeah. That is this hyper-specific story about this death metal band from East Texas. I mean, you listen to that song and it's so moving, even if you have never had any interest in death metal or have never been to Texas. There's just something about it.
Well, it's a song about two troubled kids, and John Darnielle's background before or as he was becoming a singer-songwriter was working in healthcare in psychiatric wards, mainly with children. So he had and has had his own experiences that he talks about. He's had a front row seat to trauma. He understands that these ideas resonate with people who have had any sort of deep, frustrating feelings in their lives.
So let's move on now to your next category. This is the ideal selection for the puzzle nerd in your life.
Yes. So Nathan Last is the author of a book called Across the Universe, which is an interesting history of the crossword puzzle. There is a little bit of a culture war that is going on these days when it comes to the crossword puzzles.
Ooh.
What it qualifies as common knowledge? What qualifies as popular knowledge? How do we diversify the crossword? And Nathan Last, who is both a puzzle constructor and a puzzle critic and a historian, talks about how in the 1920s when crosswords first emerged, there was something called the crossword craze. People were obsessed about it. There were moral scolds who were saying that this was brain rot, that this was going to destroy the young minds of American adults and children. And it reveals that crossword puzzles have a more sophisticated, complicated, and deep history than maybe a lot of people think.
Let's move on to your final category here, Mark. This is the ideal gift for the smarty in your life.
Yeah. So Ben Schott has put out books for years that kind of deal in kind of pub quiz esoterica. The fun thing about this particular book, which is called Schott's Significa, is that it is a four-color glossy book that deals with the weird private languages of niche groups, from Swifties to Starbucks baristas to stuntmen. For instance, a well-performed stunt is called a wreck. He has a whole section that talks about fox hunters and the people who protest the fox hunters, who are called SABs. And they each have their own language about how they discuss not only what they do, but what they are doing in the context of other people. And it speaks to, A, the vibrancy of language and just the weird sort of humor that people bring to whatever their odd little discipline is.
One of my favorite little pieces of radio lingo that it took me a really long time to understand, despite working in radio for many years, is do you know the term axe?
I do not.
Okay, so there's this term axe and tracks, and axe is actualities. So that's audio that has been gathered out in the field. Let's say you went to a political rally and you talked to a bunch of the attendees about how they feel about the candidate. Those would be your actualities. And then the tracks would be the narration that you're writing that strings those actualities together into a story. Mm-hmm. So that's your axe and tracks. And I spent years when people would say, like, do we have our axe and tracks for, you know, the piece about the J.D. Vance rally? I'd be like, we sure do. And then, like, what are they talking about?
It's weird the sort of things that people pay close attention to. There's a section about Savile Row tailors, and which who would make very, very bespoke clothes. And one term that they have is WFB, which means that it is a cut of cloth that is fit for weddings, funerals, and bar mitzvahs. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought that there is a specific kind of, you know, quality of fabric that is fit for those three in particular. But here we are.
You're paying a lot for that garment, but you're going to be able to use it at multiple events. Well, I have been speaking with Valley-based book critic and writer Mark Athatakis about the ideal gifts for various kinds of folks in your life. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, lots of books I'm going to think about getting there. Thanks for listening to the show today. That'll do it. We'll be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.